them to lose control was almost as clean a kill as eliminating them himself. The kill counter on his display ticked over regardless.
8 so far, he said out loud.
His vox crackled with the voices of his fellow hunters as they replied with their own counts.
3
6 no, 7
4
2 Godshin, 2 of those you claim are mine.
Ha! The skies are full of prey, Yakut. Why is it to claim mine?
Fair is fair, brother. With the 2, I have 8.
Torag grinned.
Trying to best me, Yakut. I but strive to follow your example, Aquilian.
Ha! Strive harder,
Torag said with a laugh.
I just caught my 9th while you were talking.
He leaned back in his control cradle as Red Hair's engines hummed, carrying him farther and faster. The stars were almost close enough to touch, or so it seemed.
Still too many, Yakut replied, and us too few to get them all. You're right, Yakut. Let us return to base. Leave them to it. I was merely pointing out.
I do not care. You are a hunter, so hunt.
Torag thumbed an activation rune and stitched the hull of a dropcraft with an autogun burst. The flimsy vessel caught fire, and its descent became uncoordinated. As it broke apart, tiny figures slipped from it, spinning upwards as gravity played its cruel games. He grinned in pleasure at the sight, imagining their screams. It was more than they deserved. But Yakut was right. More dropships pierced the tattered atmosphere, almost too many to count. And not just dropships, but gunships as well.
"Forget the dropships," he said, alerting the others to the new arrivals. "I have sighted worthier prey. Yakut, Godshin, on me! Good hunting, brothers!"
The gunships were of an unfamiliar pattern. Old things, sleek and alien-looking. In comparison, Red Hair was a box. But boxes were sturdy things, often containing surprises. Torag's smile widened. Rukan had been right. Why prowl the stars when the enemy would come to them? If they survived, he might even consider apologizing to the old wolf. Chapter 21 90-00-24 Almace, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. Amatnim stood amid the hololithic displays, watching as runes representing the trooplanders flickered and blinked out.
"How many?"
Apis asked, from the other side of the Primus Strategium plinth.
"Just over half," Amatnim said, as he rotated one of the cartographic images. "Well within the parameters for expected casualties."
2/3 of the host's trooplanders had converged on Almacia, with the remaining third spreading out to handle the other cities. The surviving pirate vessels were launching their own raids against the latter with a variety of atmospheric attack craft. Pick feeds from the surface showed hundreds of repurposed infantry assault vehicles, some dating from before the heresy, rumbling across the rocky ground away from the surviving landers. The vehicles were daubed crimson and marked with ruinous sigils and totems. Voxcasters mounted on the hulls blared atonal hymns. Inside, the mortal followers of the primordial truth bowed their heads in prayer, or checked their weapons. Their orders were to silence the anti-aircraft batteries located in the hills and crags before descending on Almacia. A simple enough task, given that most of the batteries were automated. The enemy would not waste resources defending them. Another stream of images showed the landing bays of the Glory Eternal, and the remaining gunships being readied for launch. When the battle barge had reached optimal orbit, and enough of the anti-aircraft batteries had been silenced, the gunships would pierce the atmosphere and head for Almacia. Over half of the word-bearers under his command would be making the launch, and they would not be alone. Apis studied the projections, his brow furrowed.
"Something disturbs you, brother," Amatnim said.
"Why bother landing troops at all, my lord?"
Apis asked.
"We have attack craft. Why not simply strike the enemy's heart?"
"We will,
but only when we are certain of the blow. First, we must soften the city's defences. That is where the pirates come in. Their holds are packed with the faithful, and they ferry them to their just reward. They will serve to ease our path in their own unique fashion. The cultists and diabolists would open the way for the Neverborn, spilling blood and reciting the appropriate chants. By the time Amatnim and his brothers arrived, demons would haunt the streets of Almacia, making it a more conducive sort of battlefield.
"I dislike leaving so much to lesser warriors,"
Apis looked up as the lumens of the chamber flickered. Distant klaxons whined as the Glory Eternal met the enemy in the void above Almace. Assault craft from the dockyards swarmed the battle barge like flies and were swatted aside as easily. Amatnim paid the fluctuations no mind.
"Better to risk their lives than ours."
"True, my lord,"
Apis joined him in studying the data.
"Even so, many of us will meet the gods face to face in the coming hours."
"And so, what more could we desire than that moment of perfect clarity? We were bred to die in service to a holy cause, brother. The cause may have changed, but our ultimate purpose has not."
Amatnim looked at the other word-bearer.
"Now go. Get your war dogs ready. I would launch within the hour."
Apis crossed his fists over his chest and bowed his head.
"Gloria Aeterna, my lord."
"Gloria Aeterna, brother."
Almace, Primus Asteroid Facilities. Lacamhue reached into the dying man's chest and removed his heart as easily as he might have plucked apart a piece of fruit. He held the red mass aloft, letting the blood stain his forearm and face before tossing it into the brazier with the rest.
"The hearts of 100 brave men," he murmured.
Symbolically, at least, there was no way to tell if they had been truly brave or not. It was hard to judge with mortals. He watched as a pair of slaves dragged the body of the makeshift altar, adding it to the pile of dead flesh nearby.
"What is courage, and what is merely chemicals?"
he said out loud. His voice echoed through the chamber. It was, or had been, an ore processing center. Great conveyor belts ran along reinforced plinths, leading to heavy sorting equipment and other, less familiar machinery. Servitors continued to work in the background, despite the presence of Lacamhue and his warriors. The automata had little concern for anything outside of their labours. Mist issued from the plasma vents in the walls, making the air reek of burnt rubber. Lumens flashed silent warnings about flow leakage or jams in the conveyor system. Lacamhue had disabled the klaxons in the chamber, irritated by their wailing. Keeping the facility in one piece wasn't his concern. Taking it from the enemy was. He turned to his prisoner. The Raven Guard hung from the ceiling in a web of chains, his broken limbs splayed and his blood pooling into the wide, sacrificial bowl set below him on the gantry. Lacamhue's blade slave crouched nearby, leaning against its sword. The Space Marine glared down at him through a mask of blood and bruises. Lacamhue gestured with his bloody hand.
"That is one of the eternal questions, of course. Such enigmas are the rocks of our faith. Is it courage or cowardice to serve the gods? Do we have a choice, or are we merely walking well-trodden paths? Opinions?"
The Raven Guard spat. Lacamhue smiled.
"As expected. Your kind have never been ones to ask the great questions. Or any questions, really. You know neither doubt nor fear. You lack the capacity for philosophical debate. I am sure your masters consider it a fair trade-off. But it is a shame."
He turned.
"Bring the others forward."
Word-bearers shoved a coterie of mortals towards the Dark Apostle. The miners were bloody and beaten. They cowered like whipped curs, and Lacamhue's smile widened as he took in the scent of their fear. After a moment's indulgence, he gestured.
One by one, their throats were slit, and their blood emptied into a waiting trough. More troughs, once intended as ore sluices, had been dragged forward to create a makeshift circle of significant proportions. At each, a handful of captives waited, men and women, old and young alike. The miners were a fecund lot, and they bred like vermin. Despite the defenders' best efforts, Lackamhew's warriors had taken dozens of prisoners. After the shock of the initial ambush, the word-bearers had grown more careful. Old strategies had been recalled, old tactics employed. Lackamhew had been but an aspirant the day Lorgar had sealed himself away. The heresy was not even a memory to him, but to some of the others, it was still a fresh pain. They remembered the 500 worlds and the campaigns in the dark, and they knew the enemy.
"They say your genesire still hunts somewhere in the eye,"
Lackamhew said, looking up at his captive.
"The eternal shadow cast by the light of the Astronomicon. The wages of our glorious sins. I myself do not believe it, but that is what they say."
The Raven Guard didn't answer, didn't even react. They were depressingly stoic, these milk-bloods. Lackamhew sighed and turned to watch as more prisoners were slaughtered, and their blood added to the trough. It wasn't enough yet, but soon. He needed reinforcements, but not mortal ones. He also needed them to last longer than it took for blood to dry, long enough to enforce his claim on the object of this crusade. That required a bit more effort than the usual bit of spilled blood and chanting. Most Diabolists were content to call up the Neverborn, only for the time it took to win a battle. But Lackamhew knew ways to chain them to existence for longer than that. Erebus himself had shown Lackamhew the art of opening an unhealing wound in the skin of reality. It required several days of blood and meat, and something more. A sacrifice. Not just of a life, but of lives not yet lived. Of potential. He looked at the blood congealing on his gauntlet, and then up at the Raven Guard.
"My brother sent me here to die, you know. He must have known you would be here, so he dispatched me, hoping I would be too preoccupied to prevent him from accomplishing his own task. But instead, I will turn his cunning against him."
He laughed.
"And you will help me do it."
Almace, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. For what felt like the first time in a lifetime, Prince Ganor Kabalevsky set foot on the soil of Almace. What should have been a great moment, a moment of celebration, the streets filled with thronging masses of jubilant citizens, was tainted by clouds of smoke and burning vehicles. The assault cutter rested on its landing gear, autocannons swiveling to cover the immediate area. They'd landed in what had once been an ornamental garden. The burning skeletons of fruit trees crackled softly in the wind. The blackened grasses were littered with dead birds. The air had been drawn from their tiny lungs in the vortex of the cutter's landing. Ganor stooped and picked one up.
"This isn't how I imagined it," he murmured.
He let the bird fall and turned back to the cutter. The hull was pitted from anti-aircraft fire, and he could smell oil leaking into the soil of the ravaged garden. It wasn't likely she'd make it back into the air in one piece, but that was a problem for later, and for someone else. He was here now, and he didn't intend to leave. It had taken every trick his pilots knew to get them down in one piece. Others hadn't been so lucky. From her last Vox barrage, Deal's cutters had gone down somewhere in Lowtown, well off target, which was a blessing in disguise, really. Otherwise, he'd have had to kill her, and that might have tarnished his triumph. Not that it was much of a triumph at the moment. He went to the edge of the garden, where some few trees still flowered against a wall of imported marble, and looked out over the city falling away below. A grey spiral of structures stretching to a horizon now choked with smoke. The city was larger than he remembered. Maybe it had grown in his time away. It would grow larger still, once he'd assumed his rightful place. Though the Kabalevsky clan had never been in the line of succession, he suspected such things no longer mattered. This was the beginning of a new era, or the end of an old one. The Imperium was coming apart at the seams. A blind man could see it. Amatnim had only confirmed it. The old ways were dying, one by one. New ways, new kings, were needed. He winced and rubbed his stomach, nausea from the rapid descent. Maybe nerves. Or maybe something else. The thought frightened him. He'd seen things in his exile that scared him. Men and women warped by Gellipox, diseases that seeped from the walls of salvaged ships, great shapes sliding between the distant stars. But what he'd seen aboard a Matnim's flagship. And yet, somehow, maybe it had not seemed so awful as all that. Maybe his ambition had overridden his fear. Maybe it had poisoned his brain, as Deal claimed. He shook his head. It didn't matter. He was here now. The city, the world, would be his soon enough. He wasn't so foolish as to think he could trust a Matnim, but something told him he was meant to be in this place at this moment. He remembered something his mother had often said, in her rare moments of lucidity. Every man was a story, but not every story was the same. He'd never really understood what she'd meant by that, until now. Amatnim's story was coming to an end, but the story of Prince Ganor was just beginning.
It will be a grand story indeed. Prince Ganor.
He turned to watch as the slaves of the Worldbearers spilled down the boarding ramps, chanting hymns and ringing great tocsins. He stepped back as they spilled through the garden in their hundreds. Some wore filthy robes, others gemstone-studded armor. There were women as well as men, all armed, though some carried only the most primitive of weapons.
"Cultists!"
a voice rumbled. Ganor turned. A man stood nearby, watching from the shade of one of the few unburnt trees. He was a soldier, or he had been at some point, before he'd thrown in his lot with new masters. His uniform had been dyed crimson, and his carapace armour was stained with ash and char. Sigils and runes had been carved into the flat panes with an inexpert hand. Looking at them, Ganor felt a twinge of pain at the base of his skull. His eyes slid away.
"Just cultists," the soldier said. "Don't pay them any mind."
He hefted his las rifle and joined Ganor unbidden. He had a bit of fruit plucked from the tree in hand. He proffered a piece, and Ganor took it. It wasn't as succulent as he remembered, nor as sweet. He chewed without joy.
"It's always the way,"
the soldier went on, fruit juices staining his mouth and unshaven chin.
"They send in the sacrificial meat first, and a few of us to give them spine."
He slapped the length of his las rifle.
"But always the meat first."
He chewed noisily.
"Say it sanctifies the ground, makes it so they can walk on it without offending the gods." "You worship their gods?"
It was a stupid question, given the man's uniform. The soldier shrugged.
"Got to worship something."
His flat gaze took in the cultists as they forced the wrought iron gates of the garden, using the broken remnants of a marble bench as a battering ram. Ganor saw other soldiers, clad similarly to his companion, marching down the boarding ramps, dragging heavy equipment behind them.
"It's like a fire," the soldier said. "That's what I've decided." "What?" "This. All of it. It's a fire."
He ate another piece of fruit, chewing wetly.
"It's going to burn the galaxy clean, so that we can start over."
Ganor stared at him. The soldier grinned, and Ganor thought something was moving behind the man's eyes. He looked away quickly. He felt sick.
"If we all burn, who's left to start over?"
The soldier chuckled and shrugged.
That's for the gods to say.
He dropped what was left of the fruit to the grass and wiped his mouth.
I'm just a spark in the fire.
He looked at Ganor and winked.
And now, so are you.
Ganor considered shooting him as he strode towards the other soldiers, assembling before the cutter, but he resisted the impulse. He turned back to the tree, suddenly hungry for another taste of fruit. But at some point, the fire had spread. So instead, he watched the garden burn. Chapter 22 93-30-30 Almace, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. Lowtown had been hammered flat. Fire had fallen from the sky as troop barges and gunships cleared landing zones. Pirate skiffs had joined the fun, less for strategic reasons than the pleasure of simple destruction. Now the occupants of those vessels hunted the ruins they'd made, rounding up survivors and plundering at will. And they, in their turn, were hunted. Rucken moved silently through the industrial jungle, his scouts padding in his wake. And spread out around them, the dredges of Lowtown scuttled through the forest of girders and conduits. The mortals moved with commendable silence for their sort, though to Rucken's discerning ears they were too loud. They were criminals, mostly, clad in battered or stolen combat rigs and flak armour, carrying a variety of weapons. Autoguns, slug throwers, las carbines, and a few things that even Rucken didn't recognise. Like the White Scars, they showed their affiliations openly, tattoos and gang brands on their flesh, clan colours and sigils on their clothing. They stank of industrial grime, of processed ore and sour metal. Their paws sweated narcotics, but they were hunters born, and had proved it more than once since the enemy had flooded the cramped streets of Lowtown. Knives in the dark, garrots, muffled stump pistol shots and monofilament nooses, all had been put to good use. The mortal slaves of the foe died in droves, barely aware of what had killed them. Rucken had led his motley huntsmen through the slums and drainage tunnels. They had set traps and cut fuel lines. They had even poisoned a water filtration system, killing almost 100 cultists. It was satisfying work, this. The enemy were preoccupied with reaching the Cathedral Palace, and pay little attention to the shadow war being waged around them. Then, that was often the way. Though he would never voice such thoughts openly, Rucken saw many similarities between the traitors and their loyalist opposites. Both were often blind to anything not related to the battle at hand. For them, there was only war, an incessant drumbeat guiding them and lulling them. A sad thing, when there was so much else to see. Rucken stopped as the wind turned, bringing with it the smell of unguents and incense. He gestured, and his scouts dropped prone, slithering into whatever cover was available. The gangers did the same, save for the one named Belloc, who crawled forward to join Rucken. The man was bald, and his eyes were hidden behind welder's lenses. He wore battered fatigues beneath a threadbare silk jacket, studded with good luck charms, and held a heavily modified combat shotgun close to his barrel chest.
"What is it?"
he grunted. Rucken tapped his nose.
"Smell that?"
Belloc sniffed and spat.
"Close in, quiet or loud. Depends. Come."
Rucken began to creep forward. Belloc slung his shotgun across his back and followed, though more slowly. They moved past the walls of ruptured hab units and through curtains of torn wiring and moisture netting, following the scent. The trail led them to what it had once been a market square. Rubble had been cleared away by labour gangs, and something that might have been an altar erected at the centre of the square. A crowd occupied the space, many of them clad in tattered robes and battered flak armour. Others were naked, save for the filth that smeared their forms. Men and women were dragged, screaming through the crowd, their hands bound, their faces bloody and bruised. The crowd bayed and struck at them as they passed on their way to the makeshift altar, where a tall figure, in the filthy remnants of once rich robes and a moon-shaped, grinning mask, stood waiting. Moonface raised a sickle-shaped blade and beckoned the prisoners on. Their captors hauled them forwards. Belloc fired. Moonface, the High Priest, toppled back across the makeshift altar. Rucken looked at the ganger.
"Probably not wise," he said.
Belloc replied with an obscenity and rose to his feet. As he did so, Rucken heard a hum, as of many tiny wings. Flies boiled up out of the crowd as they turned towards Rucken and Belloc. The flies surged and swarmed about them, biting and stinging. Rucken bellowed in fury and slashed out with his tulwar, trying to break up the swarm. He saw Belloc fire again and again, pumping shots into the clamoring ranks of cultists. Despite the buzzing in his ears, he heard the thump of bolt pistols and autoguns as his scouts and the gangers opened up from their positions of concealment. The square was soon awash in blood as cultists fell twitching. But the rest continued to chant and clang their tocsins, even as they fired back at the surrounding buildings. Belloc advanced into their ranks, his men following him. On the lumpen altar, the High Priest's body had begun to twitch and jerk, as if he might rise up despite his lack of a head. The droning chant reached a febrile pitch, and the air felt greasy and foul. Rucken tasted something bitter on his tongue and turned towards the altar, a warning on his lips, but too late. The High Priest's body burst open, and a long, gangling arm covered in mottled flesh reached up from within. The arm fell with a splat, and a horned head appeared, forcing its way up through the dead man's belly. A face like a squeezed pustule with one urine-coloured eye gazed about as the demon forced its narrow shoulders through the dead man's ribcage. When it braced a knobbly foot on the altar, it dragged a rust-eaten blade from the body with a lingering hiss. Time seemed to slow as the demon surveyed the realm it had been birthed into. Its mouth worked soundlessly, chewing the air. Then, half-formed and losing cohesion with every passing moment, it lunged faster and faster than it should have been able to. Its wormy blade made an awful keening sound as it passed through Belloc's shoulder and chest. As the demon ripped its weapon free, the ganger collapsed. Pale maggots sprouted from the blackening wound, gnawing at his rapidly liquefying flesh. Belloc's body twitched and jumped as the maggots devoured him and grew fat. Belloc's men scattered, some fleeing, others shooting at the creature, but to no avail. As the creature closed in on those too stubborn to retreat, Rucken bellowed wordlessly, trying to catch its attention. He ducked aside as the demon whirled towards him. It chortled something in glottal tones, but he ignored it. His tulwar danced across its tattered hide, rending it like soggy paper. Steaming ichor splattered his white armor and stung his bare arms. He backed away, pulling his bolt pistol. The demon lurched after him, losing pieces of itself with every step.
The worm crawls in. The worm crawls out. The worm squirms all about.
It grunted in a wet, ugly voice as it pursued him.
The worm goes up. The worm goes down. The worm... Quiet!
Rucken snarled and shot it in the head. Its cyclopean eye burst like a boil, spattering the ground with pus. Its skull deflated with a feculent wheeze, and the body unraveled, tumbling to the ground in bits and pieces. The cloud of flies shuddered and dissipated, leaving Rucken's head and vision clear. The plaza was full of bodies, and the stink of death was strong in the air. He looked at one of the surviving gangers.
Prometheum, burn everything, just like the last time.
He looked up as a shadow flickered across the plaza. Gunships, no way to tell whose.
They're ours.
Rucken spun, tulwar extended. Solaro raised an eyebrow as the blade came to rest against the edge of his neck. The Reaver stepped back, respectfully. He looked past Rucken.
Trouble?
No, you...
The Reaver laughed. Rucken smiled thinly. He liked the Raven Guard, despite his abnormal height. They worked well together since the siege had begun. Solaro had his own contingent of mortals to shepherd, and Rakan saw them picking their way through the carnage.
"We heard the shooting. Cultists," Rakan said and spat.
"More of them since yesterday, though."
He sheathed his blade. Every day brought more of them, in landing craft or crawling over the mountains. And that was just Lowtown.
"Yes."
Solaro indicated the upper reaches of the city.
"All heading that way. Siege weapons, too. Tanks and artillery."
Rakan turned.
"Best to contact the lieutenant, then."
"Think he'll want us to go?"
Rakan spat again.
"Doesn't matter. That's where I'm going."
Almace, Primus Asteroid Facilities. Karos leaned over the flickering schematic, frowning.
"They're pulling back to the ore processors."
He traced the image with a finger, causing it to hum softly. As it flickered, it cast sharp shadows on the dingy walls of the chamber. Originally, it had been an ore vein, but as the shaft had been stripped bare, the miners had reinforced it and made it an extension of the facility, turning it into a catch-all chamber, a storage area or a place for the swing shift to sleep. Thousands of similar sites dotted the asteroid's insides. At the moment, it was Karras's headquarters. Enforcers and miners moved about, stacking supplies or studying maps, planning future operations. Women and children huddled in the corners, cooking or loading weapons. An elderly missionary, Zebus, that was his name, read haltingly from the Lectitio Divinitatis to an attentive crowd. Ravengard moved about the chamber, overseeing the preparations. Sometimes they stopped to advise or comment, but mostly they watched. That was as it should be, Karras thought. Space Marines were powerful, worth 100 lesser souls, but they were finite. With the proper training, the miners could continue to resist the enemy after the last Ravengard had perished. That they would all perish was an unspoken certainty among them. The enemy outnumbered them, despite the heavy losses the traitors had taken in the initial ambush. There would be no reinforcements from Almace. The Ravengard would fight and die, one by one. But the miners might live, might survive. That was enough. Karras glanced at Darren.
"Any word from Spyros?"
The other Ravengard shook his head.
"I can't even pitch into his pit to feed. His armor's offline."
Karras's frown deepened. There was only one conclusion to draw from that.
"He's lost to us,"
Darren said. It wasn't a question. Karras shook his head. Spyros wasn't the first of their number to fall, but something felt off about it.
"Maybe not. They're planning something. The assaults here and here. They were more like raids, wouldn't you say?"
He looked over at Reyes and Desh. The enforcer had his helmet off as well, and his features were haggard and bloody. Reyes handed him a cup of steaming recaf, and he thanked her with a brusque nod. Desh nodded as he sipped his drink.
"Oh, don't have much experience with it, but yes, smash and grab, rather than trying to take ground."
He looked at Reyes.
"How many did they take?"
She looked away.
"We don't know. They hit one of the secure hub areas. At least, we thought it was secure."
She concentrated on her recaf. Desh hesitated and then reached out, as if to comfort her. She twitched away from him, and he let his hand fall. Karras watched this interplay with mild interest before turning his attention back to the problem at hand.
"Why take prisoners?"
he said out loud. He looked at Darren.
"If you were one of them, why burden yourself with captives? Hostages." "No, they know we will not bargain."
Reyes stiffened at that, but said nothing. Karras met her gaze and she looked away.
"A ritual," he said.
Darren grunted. Like Karras, he knew how the Wordbearers fought.
"Makes sense. They're running short of chaff, and the traitors probably aren't eager to waste their own lives. Not when they can."
He trailed off. Something that might have been a shudder ran through him. Space Marines knew no fear. That was the assumed wisdom, at any rate. But they could be unsettled, made uneasy by things outside of their comprehension. Demons were such a thing. They were elements of wrongness imposed on reality. Karras had fought them more than once, even before the Indomitus Crusade. Some chapters mind-wiped those battle brothers, unfortunate enough to encounter such creatures. But the Raven Guard were wiser than most. Experience with such opponents was worth more than any potential harm such knowledge brought. Too, with the opening of the Great Rift, such knowledge had become sadly undeniable. The Damned had set foot on Holy Terra, and nothing would ever be the same.
If they are preparing for such a thing, we must stop it. Like as not, we are already out of time, but even so, we must try.
He expanded the schematic.
There are four main routes to the ore processors.
Six,
Reyes corrected. Karras looked at her, and she pointed to the schematic.
Processing chutes. Ore goes in, gets melted down, and fed into the refineries on the next level. It's a clear climb, if you've got the strength for it. They're still firing, though. No way to get through them without cutting the power.
Unless you're wearing power armor,
Derrim murmured. Karras nodded after a quick calculation.
We'd have to be quick. Even our battle plate isn't going to withstand those temperatures for long. Doable, though, with luck.
I didn't realize Space Marines believed in luck,
Desh said. His eyes widened as he realized that he'd spoken out loud. Hastily, he looked down at his cup. Karras smiled.
Luck is as keen a blade as this one on my hip.
He indicated his combat knife for emphasis.
But you must be careful, lest it turns in your hand.
He looked at Darren.
Coming up through those chutes, we'll be right in the middle of them, and with no time to analyze the situation beforehand. Bad for an assault,
Darren said.
Good for a distraction, though.
Karras looked at Reyes and Desh. The humans glanced at one another, and then at him. Karras smiled.
Don't worry. I have a plan.
Almes, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. Explosions rocked the Relicuri Boulevard. A building groaned and slumped on its foundations as its broken walls spilled across the side street, erasing it from sight.
That's the last of them, Canonus Law said. The fire corridor is finished.
Good,
Calder replied. They stood upon the steps leading up to the distant shape of the Cardinal's Gate, overseeing the final defensive preparations. The steps were wide, slab things that rose steeply upwards for several leagues. Landings jutted from them at points, connected to causeways that led elsewhere in the city. At the very top of the steps was the gate itself, a towering edifice of bronze and iron, hung with bells and censers. Bulwarks had been erected on the landing before it, providing a final redoubt. Despite the best efforts of Torag and the city's defences, the enemy had managed to land assault cutters and dropships throughout Armacia. Thousands of troops had spilled into the streets, mostly in Lowtown, but there were determined pockets elsewhere, and more arriving with every hour. The ships in orbit were emptying their guts over the planet. He knew the scene would be the same in the other cities, though most of the enemy's efforts were concentrated here. That was fine by Calder. Below him, battle sisters and imperial fists alike made ready for the arrival of the enemy. More squads of both were scattered throughout the upper reaches of the city, concentrated around the processional way. That thoroughfare was the main artery of the city, connecting the depths of Lowtown to the spires of High, and the most likely route of the enemy advance. It had seen the passage of millions of pilgrims over the centuries since Almacia's founding. Great statues of saints and ecumenical personages overlooked the wide boulevard, from column plinths strung with great webs of electrical lightning, and a canopy of hanging censers that filled the air with the sweet stink of incense. The censers swayed in the breeze, and ribbons of smoke drifted down from above, briefly interfering with Calder's auto-sensors, before they automatically compensated. Statues had been toppled at designated locations, creating a makeshift choke point. The relic keeper, responsible for taking care of them, had gone into frenzied convulsions, even as the first had been forced from its plinth, wailing imprecations upon the heads of the desecrators. Luckily, Canonus Law had been on hand to see to the matter. Calder glanced up. The body of the relic keeper hung from the canopy among the censers, twisting gently in the breeze. As he watched, one of the dead man's sandals slipped from a limp foot and fell to the street. Calder followed its trajectory idly. He felt only the dullest glimmer of pity for the man. But even so, he wondered if there had not been a better way. Something of that must have showed in his body language, for Law cleared her throat.
"You seem displeased," she said.
Calder looked down at her, somewhat startled by her perceptiveness.
"The most efficient solution is not always the most optimal," he said after a moment.
Law smiled, her scarred features making the expression almost a grimace.
"He was given a command by the Cardinal Governor. He failed to obey. The punishment for such heresy is death."
"You sound almost gleeful, Canoness."
Her smile widened, becoming almost grotesque.
"I am ecstatic, Lieutenant. At last, my faith is rewarded. Aemon has been kind, too kind, to those who defy him. Now, the time for kindness is done. The weak and sinful will be purged by this tribulation. This is a baptism of fire, from which a new Almes will rise, stronger and blessed in the eyes of him who guides us."
She made a fist.
"Our faith will light the dark, and we shall cast our defiance into the teeth of the God Emperor's foes."
Calder said nothing. He wondered what she would make of all that he had seen and heard in those ancient days, before he had been consigned to the vaults to await Gilliman's summons. Two, what would be her reaction to Aemon's prisoner? Would her faith shatter at the sight of the anchorite, or would it only redouble itself? Then, part of him suspected that she already knew. He could not say which thought unsettled him more. A vox operator signalled them.
"It's Swordmaster Tyre, my lord,"
the man said nervously. He was a member of one of several squads assigned to the Cardinal's Gate, in support of Law's battle sisters and Calder's intercessors.
"Channel 26 Alpha."
Calder cycled through the vox signals until he found the correct frequency.
"Tyre, this is Calder. Status?"
"It's as you predicted, Lieutenant. Lowdown is indefensible. I'm ordering a general withdrawal. You might want to let the White Scars know."
"No need. Rucken has his orders. He'll bleed them from below as we hammer them from here. Pull back to the Cardinal's Gate and disperse your formations across Hightown. We'll join you in 5 standard hours."
"You seem confident."
"No confidence. Experience. They'll lose most of their momentum in Lowtown. Discipline will begin to break down. They'll be looking to enjoy themselves, or for reinforcements."
He paused, wondering how best to explain, but Tyre saved him the trouble.
"Reinforcements,"
Tyre said, and laughed harshly.
That's one word for it. Speak plain, Lieutenant. They'll be looking to unleash the legions of hell on us."
"Yes, but Rucken will do what he can to prevent that. As will we."
He paused again.
"If we can't, we will need to alter our strategy."
"I will make the Cardinal Governor aware of the situation."
Calder cut the link and looked at Law.
"You heard?"
She grinned.
"Oh, yes. I'm looking forward to it."
She closed her eyes and leaned her head back, as if scenting the air.
The chance to fight the arch-enemy again is truly a gift from the God Emperor."
Calder's vox clicked.
"Solaro," he said. "Status?"
"Busy,"
came the reply.
"So I assumed. Report."
"Siege weapons moving along the northern causeway, towards the Pilgrim's Gate."
Calder frowned, as he'd predicted. The enemy would seek to breach the gate and bring the weapons through Hightown, in order to train them on the Cathedral Palace.
"Focus your efforts on disabling those weapons. I don't want them getting in range of the palace."
"Might be too late already."
"Then do what you can."
"Trouble?"
Law asked. Calder looked down at her.
"Only the expected variety."
Law smiled.
"They are predictable in my experience. Puppets to fell powers, unable to..."
She was interrupted by a shout from the end of the street. A battle sister hurried towards the steps.
"Aisha, Lors said, descending to meet the other woman.
Something to report, sister? The enemy, Canoness! They come!
Lors laughed, low and savage. She looked at Calder, her gaze wild, and he nodded. She laughed again, and quickly descended the rest of the way to the street. Calder followed more slowly. With the fire corridor in place, the street was a killing field. The enemy would charge and die. He'd made sure to leave them no other choice. He could hear them now, even without his auto-sensors. The clanging of great bells and the piping of flutes, shouts and hymns and the rattle of undisciplined gunfire. Kenric, one of his intercessors, was waiting for him at the bottom of the steps.
"Estimates put enemy numbers at several hundred," Kenric said, as he fell into step with Calder. "Maybe three. No organization to speak of. Just humans. So far."
Calder nodded.
"The traitors won't show themselves until they're sure of support. This is just a distraction."
Shouts now from the other end of the street. Soldiers fell back, taking up position behind the outermost bulwarks. Law was already there, exhorting her followers in ringing tones. Calder signalled his intercessors with a single vox click. They would hold the centre. It was imperative that the defenders see them doing so. Morale was as much a weapon as a bolt rifle. His display flickered and magnified the opposite end of the street. He could see them coming. Thin, feral faces, some masked, others bare, twisted bodies wrapped in rags or plundered armour, carrying weapons as poorly treated as their wielders. They carried standards made from scrap metal and rotting body parts, or great bells that clanged hollowly. Calder had made a study of the battlefield markings of the enemy, at least those it was safe to look at. He recognised the primitive heraldry of at least three distinct groups, all of them far from home. Some of them he'd fought before, as the Indomitus Crusade stretched across the stars.
"Place your shots! Standards and leaders first," he said. "Kill anyone shouting orders. Leave the slaughter to Law and the others."
He did not bother to check that they had heard him. They would follow orders. The bulwark was tall enough to shelter the Primaris Marines, but just barely. Calder set his shoulder against the ferrocrete and peered over the top. The enemy were flooding into the street, howling and chanting.
"Animals," Kenric said softly.
Calder glanced at him.
"No. That is what makes this all the worse."
He turned, checking the rest of the line. Men and women in Ecclesiarchy Red clutched their weapons with nervous intensity. Some were afraid, others eager. But he was satisfied that they would hold. Law prowled behind them, her voice raised in exultation.
"Raise your voices to the heavens, so that the God Emperor might hear you," she cried, lifting her crackling power maul. "Sing, sisters! Sing, penitents! Sing!"
She wheeled her flat gaze, sweeping across the ranks of soldiers and sororitas.
"Sing the song of our last days! Sing so that we are not forgotten! Meet their demon hymns with our own holy song! Sing!"
And they sang. Calder watched in silence as the troopers first raised their voices in song and then their lasguns, setting them across the barricades. The sororitas followed suit, their voices more practiced. Battle hymns were as much a part of their arsenal as the bolter. He raised his own weapon.
"On my mark,"
he said through the vox.
"Shall we sing as well, Lieutenant?"
Kenric asked. Calder looked at him.
"Sing if you wish, Kenric, so long as you can shoot at the same time."
Targeting runes flickered to life as the first of the foe reached maximum optimal range. Calder felt a flicker of pity for the debased figures racing towards him through the dust. Misplaced faith had led them to their deaths, as surely as if they'd put guns to their own heads. But they'd made their choice, and now would suffer the consequences. The voices of the faithful met in the dusty air, and for a moment, Calder imagined the songs twisting in battle above his head. Then, the first lasbolts erupted from the bulwarks, and several cultists fell, their howls cut short. But more pressed forward, trampling the bodies of the fallen in their eagerness to reach their foes.
Behind him, Kenric began to sing. One by one, the other intercessors joined him, and the deep, basso rumbling of their voices stretched out. Troopers shot nervous glances their way, and their singing faltered, but Lore nodded in evident pleasure. "See!" she shouted. "See! The angels of the Emperor add their voices to yours! You are blessed, you sons and daughters of Almes! Show them your thanks! Sing!" Once more, the song rose, bolstered by the throbbing pulse of Primaris' voices. The enemy raced towards the barricades, and Calder's targeting runes flashed green.
"Fire!"
he said. Bolt rifles thundered, and the foe died. Chapter 23 95-10-20 Almes, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. Duseb watched in satisfaction as the trio of heavily armoured Deimos pattern Vindicators rumbled up the throughway. Their demolisher cannons thundered one after the other, shattering the foundations of the causeways and clearing the streets of rubble. In their wake, mortal chaff marched in rigid formation under the watchful eyes of Legion overseers. Duseb always favoured martial rigour over theological. Off the battlefield, faith was between a man and his gods. On the battlefield, Duseb was the only deity his slaves needed to worry about. The word-bearer stood atop the observation cupola of a heavy Medusa field gun. Behind him, his slaves rang their tocsins and called out the eightfold prayers of far slaughter. The ancient weapon had seen him through 1,000 sieges. Its red flanks were marked by kill runes, and he trained its crew himself. The Medusa growled as its treads crunched over broken bulwarks, and he patted the top of its blast shield affectionately. Red drifts of bodies were flattened beneath the Medusa's weight as the advance growled forward. There were larger corpses mixed in among the mortal meat, imperial fists, but only a few, a bare handful, and not enough to stop him. He studied the bodies as his brothers plundered them, taking sections of battle plate or even gene seed. The latter was worth a lord's ransom in the eye. It was also a delicacy among certain fraternal lodges. As he watched, two word-bearers shucked their helms and shared a meal of raw gene-seed, gobbling it down with no thought to the mortals who might be observing them. Duseb sighed at their lack of civility and made note, intending to chastise them later. Discipline had to be maintained, especially in front of the slaves.
"My lord, the Pilgrim's Gate is just up ahead,"
one of his assistants quavered. Duseb looked down at the mortal and cuffed him, knocking him sprawling.
"I am aware. Do not speak again unless it is to tell me something I do not know."
Duseb looked up as an assault cutter, one of several, scythed overhead. The bulky vessels were archaic, even by his standards. Little more than aerodynamic drop pods, and armed to the teeth. They were hurtling towards the prearranged drop points, their bellies full of mortal meat. Slave soldiers and cultists. Their blood would sanctify the battlefields above, calling the children of the gods to war. He frowned at the thought. Demons always complicated what should be a relatively simple matter. He heard shouts from behind the Medusa, and saw that the troops following in his wake had stopped. He could hear them arguing with each other from here. While the cults made for excellent battlefield chaff, they had exaggerated notions of their own importance. Get enough of them together in one place, and they started vying to be top of the midden heap. Even slaves had a hierarchy, however ridiculous the notion. Duseb looked down at his cowering aide.
"On your feet, maggot. We have a rendezvous to reach. Get them moving."
He reached for the lash hanging from his belt as the mortal scrambled to his feet and leapt down from the Medusa.
"You shouldn't beat them so,"
a nearby word-bearer said.
"They are fragile, and there are better uses for their pain."
"Hello, Morkesh.
Come to
contribute to the war effort.
Dusseb looked down at the other word-bearer. Morcash was a Diabolus by inclination. He wore a ritual harness, studded with spirit bottles and prayer scrolls, and there were sensors built into the cooling vents of his armor's power pack. Sweet-smelling smoke cloaked him at all times, and it seemed to take the shape of leering faces whenever the wind blew just right.
"Maybe conjure up some living siege weapons for us, eh?"
"Mockery, brother."
Dusseb laughed. Morcash sounded annoyed. That was good. Dusseb wasn't overly fond of Morcash, or Diabolists in general. Neverborn might be blessed of the gods, but they were a curse on the battlefield. He couldn't give them orders, no matter what fools like Morcash claimed. They were like a natural disaster. You just had to hope that they went in the right direction.
"No. No, of course not. I wouldn't dare. Why are you here?"
"I go where I am needed."
"I don't recall asking for your help, brother."
"I don't recall offering it, brother."
Morcash looked around.
"Ah, the winds of chaos blow strong here. Demons press close all about us, clawing at the barriers between worlds. They smell the blood of the fallen."
"Is that what that stink is?"
Dusseb made a show of looking around.
Well, where are they, then? I can't see them, and I have very keen eyes."
Morcash ignored him and crouched, tracing his fingers through the effluvia on the ground. Dusseb shook his head and turned away, slightly repulsed. Despite his jibes, he could feel the Neverborn as easily as Morcash, if not perceive them. The air felt oily when they were about. It felt wrong, as if the universe had grown ill. Dusseb did not consider himself especially devout. He knew the names of the gods and made the ceremonial ablutions on the holy days. He painted his battleplate the correct shades, when necessary. But the gods were remote things. They prowled battlefields far beyond those ruled by Dusseb and his brothers. Like many in the Legion, he did just enough to avoid drawing the ire of the gods or their representatives, but no more than that.
"They're coming,"
Morcash said.
"I thought they were already here."
Morcash looked at him.
"They are both here and not. The universe has been made permeable, and things may be in two places at once."
"Yes. Things have changed, haven't they?"
Dusseb sighed.
"Things were simpler in the old days, before all this confusion. Gods and demons, when it was just a man and his faith and the desert."
He turned and studied the distant spires of the cathedral palace. He began to calculate how best to crack it. Morcash laughed.
"Yes, it is a grand time to be alive."
There was a sound on the air, as of chains rattling, or hooves stamping. The oily sensation had grown worse. The mortals had fallen silent, and even the other word-bearers paused watchfully.
"God's grant that it stays that way," Dusseb muttered.
Almes, Primus Asteroid Facilities. Hasht warmed his gloved hands over a plasma vent as the Blessed Ones went about their holy work. He kept his distance, as was only prudent. Too close, and the gods might decide to add his soul to their bounty. It was cold in the chamber, despite the heat issuing from the vents. The miners had damaged the environmental controls on this level. The Blessed Ones hadn't noticed, wouldn't notice, until Hasht and the others started freezing to death. He pulled the collar of his uniform tight, trying to ward off the chill. Around him, the remainder of his brotherhood stood watching the proceedings with the appropriate levels of awe and appreciation. He studied their faces, noting those who were missing. Their membership had never been as large as some, and it had shrunk drastically in the past few days, from several hundred to barely 60. Men and women he had sworn blood oaths with were gone, their bodies crushed and lost, or frozen stiff on the asteroid surface. Worse,
Most of them had died without seeing the faces of their enemy. Those who were left, he barely knew, or didn't want to. He raised his hands, flexing them, feeling the ache of the cold. It wasn't much different, this. Serving the Blessed Ones or serving in an Astra Militarum regiment, you still wound up cold and far from home. You still wound up on a stone, with a knife at your heart. If the gods wanted you, they'd have you one way or another. Better to serve them willingly than be served up to them. That's what the Blessed Ones said. He watched them, careful not to look directly at them. They didn't like that. Some of them would tolerate it, but most would kill a man the way Hasht would kill a fly. Then, the Emperor's angels weren't much different. He looked away as they killed another group of miners and dumped their blood into the troughs. Bodies were stacked like ingots in the corner of the chamber. Some of those in his brotherhood were already eyeing them hungrily. Protein was protein, and it had been a day or two since any of them had anything more than a ration bar. Hasht wasn't that hungry, quite yet, but he knew he soon would be. He wondered whether he'd be able to stomach it this time. He reached for his canteen, but found it empty. They hadn't yet managed to get to the hydrogen cyclers for the facility. He turned to one of the others, a hard-faced woman named Skeeda, and gestured. "Water," he said. "No water," she said, handing him a battered flask. He took a swig and nearly choked on it. Whatever it was burned like hot embers going down his throat. Gasping, he handed it back. She grinned.
"Bartered it from the half-breeds on the gunnery decks. They brew it in the siphon tanks. Good, eh?"
"No,"
he said, pouring at his mouth. It felt as if his lips were peeling.
"Keeps you alert, though, and keeps you from getting hungry."
She took a swallow and rolled it around in her mouth. He watched the crude ritual tattoos on her face flex and squirm. Similar patterns adorned his own flesh. He tapped his cheek.
"Akil do yours too?"
Akil had been their brotherhood's right keeper. He was dead now. Something had twisted his head off in one of the southern junctions. Skeeda nodded.
"Just before we left Pergamon."
She touched her cheek.
"The Blessed Ones watched. Akil said it made the ink flow smooth."
Hasht nodded. That sounded like Akil.
"Never seen them this close," he said quietly. "Never realized how big they are, how badly they smell," he said.
Skeeda snorted and clapped a hand over her mouth. Hasht smiled. She shook her head.
"They'd kill you if they heard you."
He shrugged.
"They heard me. They don't care. And they smell like rancid meat and spoiled blood. Like a battlefield." "Or a charnel house," she said. "Akil used to say that some of them rub fat and incense on their armour to keep it shiny."
She took another swig.
"Feel that. They're calling up the hunters from deep places."
Hasht shivered. The ritual had been going on for days, and would for several more, if the others were to be believed.
"Never seen one up close. You?"
She nodded, her face tight.
"Once."
She stuffed her flask back into her armour.
"Didn't like it. Don't like it."
She looked at him, and he saw fear in her eyes. And something else.
"Come,"
she said softly. She held out her hand. After a moment's hesitation, he took it. She led him away from the others, back towards the processor chutes. The heavy, chimney-like structures blared a welcome heat, and the clangour of their function drowned out the sounds of the ritual. The servitors were still at their stations, hard at work. They didn't stop, even when Skeeda kissed him. Her lips were rough against his, and he could taste the alcohol on her breath. There was fear there, and loneliness too. They were afraid all the time. Sometimes Hasht wondered if there'd ever been a time he hadn't been afraid. These little moments were all any of them had. A few minutes to forget the fear and the worry. To think about something other than attracting the ire of the Blessed Ones and the Dark Gods. Just a few precious moments of peace. Skeeda pushed back from him, panting slightly. He made to speak, but the words turned to dust on his lips, as he saw it. Something black and terrible, rising over the lip of the chute above, its form steaming, its eyes red as blood, glaring down at him, glaring right through him. And he thought, just for a moment, of shouting, of crying out a warning. But the moment passed, and then it was too late to say anything at all. Almace, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. The interior of the gunship shook as it dropped through the atmosphere. Warning lumens bathed everything in a warm red light as pressure valves clicked rhythmically. Amatnim ducked through the bulkhead, separating the pilot's compartment from the rest of the ship.
"You wanted to see me, brother?"
"Yes, my lord."
The pilot was hooked snugly into his control throne, conduits and cables connected to numerous feed ports on his armor. Over the centuries, those ports had begun to take on a disturbingly organic texture, and they seemed to pulse and twitch in time to the pilot's movements. The rest of the crew were servitors, or had been. Now they were part of the gunship, semi-sentient synaptic nodules, their restraint cradles grown into hard, scabby tumors that hid all but their slack features. The pilot had no name, save that which he shared with his vessel, Golan. For all intents and purposes, man and machine were one and the same. When the pilot spoke, so too did the guiding machine spirit of the gunship. Amatnim was sure only that both were loyal to the Legion, and to him in particular.
"One moment, please," he said.
The reinforced viewscreen showed the upper atmosphere. Flickering ident runes spun across the screen, marking the locations of the other gunships and troop landers dropping towards the city. Explosions tore at the already ravaged air, ground flak rising from the upper reaches of the city. Apis winced as the edges of an explosion washed across Golan.
"That was close,"
the pilot spoke up.
"No, it wasn't."
Another explosion followed. The glare of it momentarily filled the viewscreen. The gunship shuddered and veered. Apis stumbled and Amatnim steadied him.
"That one was,"
the pilot added with an unpleasant chuckle. The city spun beneath them, spreading to fill the viewscreen. Slabs and stretches of white and grey spilled among the brown of the crater mountains. The explosions came faster and larger the lower they went. Flak towers hammered at the city as tracer fire spun and spiraled. A troop carrier was pierced clean through. A lucky shot. The great vessel listed, spewing smoke and gouts of flame. The pilot murmured a command, and the servitors replied in hissing, static-laced voices. The gunship banked away from the burning vessel. Amatnim leaned forward, watching the troop carrier plummet towards the city, like a newborn comet.
"How many were aboard that one, do you think?" he said.
"A few hundred,"
Apis said.
"Only immortals, though."
"No loss there, then."
Amatnim turned. He recognized some of the ident runes on the screen, the atmospheric cutters employed by the pirates in their raids. Ganor was making good on his part in the strategy. Some of the cutters disintegrated in mid-descent, cut to ribbons by the flak, but others streaked downwards, thrusters firing. The pilot grunted a curse as tracers skidded past Golan's prow. He thumbed an activation rune on his display, and the gunship's assault cannons roared. Targeting runes spun across the display as he returned fire, attempting to silence the closest flak tower. A burst of flame and smoke from below spoke to his skill in such matters.
"There! Ought to buy us a few moments."
He glanced at Amatnim.
"We will be entering the city's airspace within the hour, my lord," he said. "Unfortunately, we are suffering a distinct lack of safe landing zones within reach of the designated target area."
He gestured without turning from his viewscreen. A hololithic schematic flickered into view above his throne. For a moment, it resembled a nest of squirming snakes. Then, it resolved itself into a plan of the city. Augur sweeps and information provided by Ganor and the other pirates had given the word-bearers a wealth of valuable information. Amatnim had identified at least half a dozen sites, which they might set down just from a cursory glance. These were all illuminated on the schematic.
"There are three options," the pilot said. "None of them good."
What about these?
Amatnam gestured to several of the other illuminated areas on the schematic.
Long-range augurs detected concealed weapons points, and thermal readings that can only be explosive charges. We land at any of those, we won't be in one piece for long.
Amatnam grunted.
Huh, smart. Give us three doors that all lead to the same choke point, and all the while they'll be stalling Duceb.
He shook his head.
Imperial fists. Stubborn and infuriating to the last.
He gestured, and the schematic rotated.
The key to any victory is to force your opponent to react to your choices, rather than the opposite. So let's avoid those poison chalices they've so kindly left out, and choke them on their own hubris. Meaning?
Apis asked.
We're going to enact a rapid assault drop.
He looked at the pilot.
You know how to make a controlled crash, I trust.
The pilot looked up at him. He was silent for a moment before answering,
I know enough to know that I would rather not, my lord.
The gunship seemed to shudder in agreement around them.
Sometimes the gods ask that we take the hard road, brother. Contact the other gunships. I want you to plow right through whatever defenses they've erected. Carry us right into the heart of them. Bold, especially since we might not survive,
Apis said.
And we won't be able to extract ourselves if we scrape these birds across the road. We have plenty of gunships, and as I've said before, brother, the gods love a gambler.
Amatnam leaned over the pilot's shoulder.
Take us in, brother, and sing them a hymn of fire as you do.
Chapter 24, 95-15-40 Almes, Primaris Grade Cardinal World. Ord